celebrating success, learning from legends, and growing poppies. This is Tall Poppy Talk with Grace Lewis. Kia ora and welcome to Tall Poppy Talk. Today we have Dr. Tara Quinn. She is a chartered and HCPC registered counselling psychologist and associate fellow of the British Psychological Society. With over 20 years of clinical experience and deep knowledge of mental health and disability and human behaviour, one of Tara's specialties is helping people to take a fresh look at long-standing issues. Tara is also an author, fellow podcaster, director of the Conversation Starter Project, and founder of the Human Animal Welfare Alliance. With her The Adversity Psychologist podcast, covering topics from, I loved it, it was befriending your brain, coping with illness, and changing the way we talk about mental health and suicide. Literally such a spectrum. Tara is committed to sparking conversations and spreading her knowledge, whether it be auditory, written, or video storytelling. And her recent publication, she's got at least two books, is Mental Health Micro Gains, co-written with Dr. Emma Cottrell. It dives into 50 small actions that will make a big difference to your well-being. So with lots to dive into and already some we talked about before the intro, it's a real pleasure, Tara, to welcome you today to Tall Poppy Talk. My first question is, where and how are you today?
It's lovely to be here. So I am in the south of the UK. I'm in West Sussex and I'm good, thank you. It's nice to be a guest on someone else's podcast. Just finished recording one of my own, so it's nice to be on the other side.
Absolutely. And it's very comforting for me as the host to know, like, already just your patience and gratitude leading into this episode is it's awesome, for lack of a better words.
We get it, don't we? We know what the techie issues are like, and having self-compassion.
Yes. And for those listeners, I think it was hilarious. I behind the curtains, I had technical issues, so I get on and then Tara just says, like, it's okay, calm so down. And here I am. The roles are reversed. But that just shows your very nature, and clearly, as I just went through in the intro, like, the depth of experience, practical, like, academic, all across the board. When you come across new people like me, you just, all that wisdom just immediately translates. So thank you.
We're just human, right? And things happen. And we need to be a bit kinder to ourselves. I'm rubbish at that, so I'm trying to get better.
I think that's fair. It's kind of nice. This sounds terrible, but it's nice to hear when an expert like you says it as well.
It's so refreshing, and we're doing it more, which I love, actually, showing the human side of mental health professionals, I think, starts better conversations with people about their well-being.
And speaking of conversations, this first question I have for you is, like, it's a lofty one, but...
Bring it on.
It's just like, so your journey into psychology, mental health communities, like, where did your passion for mental health start?
Such a good question. Right way back. So when I did the equivalent of A-levels over in here in the UK, which is probably high school equivalent for you guys, I used to do a bit of voluntary work for people who had learning disabilities. And that's when I first kind of had that practical experience of working with people with additional needs. And that led me to want to study a bit more at uni and then getting to work with different client groups. Then I used to work with people with head injuries. And I like the practical side. I like being with people and learning from them, not just the academic side. So the two things just fell naturally for me. And then I went on and did my training, and other things have just, I'll be honest, they're not planned. They just kind of fall into place. I just meet people, find an area and think this works. And I'm a natural problem solver. So I'm quite good at going, where is there a need? Why hasn't someone looked at it? And I'm going to look at it and do something about it. And I will, so stubborn, I'll keep going until I get there. So slow and steady, but I will keep going until I get there. And I like groups in society that get a little bit forgotten about. So it's why when you look at my CV, they're groups, they're demographics that don't usually get so much attention in terms of their needs and their mental health needs.
And then in regards to you and the day-to-day, is like, because they're typically, those communities typically aren't getting their needs sought to. I'm kind of visual in the sense that like their cup is very low.
Yeah.
And so you probably spend more than that. I'm not generalizing other psychologists, professionals, but like because you're working in communities that are underseen and undersupported, your capacity must have to be like very high because there's more for you to, there's a never ending like need for you.
Yes. And I guess one thing that's really interesting is that's what tops up my cup. So I don't like every day what I call kind of stale mental health. I don't like rote learn. This is what we do. This is how we do it. So I'm quite innovative. I'm not everybody's cup of tea because of that. That's such a British phrase, isn't it? I'm not everyone's thing because I do stuff a bit outside of the box. And because I work with groups and then start to see that change or start to see people talk about them more, that's what then makes me feel good, tops my cup up to be able to do more of that work. So it's a nice little cycle, really. But I see the change, makes me want to be more innovative, makes me want to do more work. So it goes.
Have you heard the phrase like relentless curiosity?
Yes. That's me in
That's
a nutshell.
You. Yes. Yeah.
So is. Yeah.
Yeah. As soon as you said that, I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
And I also like in the intro, I mentioned podcast, you just did a podcast, you're in the field, you're also founding the like Animal Alliance, and then also you just mentioned before working on something to like make a national legal change with, could you talk about that part again, because I thought that was so fascinating.
So in the UK, anybody can call themselves a psychologist, which means that there are some people that may take advantage of that and are seeing and offering mental health services to people without adequate training and adequate management of risk. So at the moment, we have a petition going through Parliament. It's on hold because we had a general election here, so it will start again soon, to help hopefully make a change in the law to help the public understand a bit more. So when they're searching for a psychologist, they can understand who is appropriate to see and who isn't. And there are different types of psychologists, I must be really clear on that. There are psychologists that work in research, but it's just about who is it that is appropriately qualified and trained to be offering mental health services to the public.
Thank you. I'm really excited and hoping, like part of me is shocked, like, yeah. What do you mean anyone can say, like, that just feels wrong.
You could do it now, set up a website and see people if you're in the UK, and there's nothing legally anyone can do about that, which is okay, we get that, but as a member of the public, if you are vulnerable, if you are seeking out support for yourself or someone else, and you're seeing these flashy titles, these people can be members of professional bodies but not qualified with them, if that makes sense, so then they can have lovely logos on their website that to an unsuspecting member of the public you would presume, oh, you must be qualified, you must be adequately trained. So it's just about starting that journey, helping people learn a little bit more to make informed choices and safe choices about who they see.
Definitely, because I'm sure the UK is very similar to New Zealand, very similar to probably a global thing where it's like there is such a lack of, and people are trying, but there is definitely a lack of resources,
yes,
in regards,
yeah, absolutely.
And like the wait list to try and see someone is quite extensive. So
yes,
it's not that people with ill intent, you know, we're making generous assumptions.
Yes. Yeah.
It's not that people with ill intent are advertising themselves as psychologists and they're not trained. It's like if you are desperate and you see that suddenly the national, like the public healthcare system has a 3-4 month wait list, you are going to go online and you find someone who's at a fraction of the price. And that's where, to your point, it's not safe because like you've got someone who's desperately seeking something and then someone who's probably wanting to actually help but just isn't trained. And for me, that's such a dangerous combination because it's
perfect storm, really, isn't it? Yeah.
A very vulnerable person. Exactly.
Absolutely. And off the back of the pandemic as well, because a lot of people then were working online, we've had the rise of coaching, which is fantastic in so many ways, but it's about staying in your lane. I'll be really bold with that. And there are many fantastic things that coaches to do, that various clinicians can do. And even within psychology, we need to stay in our lanes and who we work with and how we work with. And it's just helping the public to understand that, really, and being ethical in what we do. That's what I'm about.
I love that. Ethical, a word that I try to think of a lot for myself, other than patience, is integrity. So it's because I'm not a professional, I'm not in the field, like maybe ethical would make more sense if I was. But for me, it's like, do I have integrity in what I do on the day to day?
What are your values, human, about how you want to treat others, how you want to conduct yourself. I do a lot of values-based work, and I love that. And the values-based work, it's interesting, includes what are my values around being a kind of ethical, moral practitioner, but also that open and curious stance that we take. I really value that, you know, looking at situations and not just following the herd in how we manage stuff, because that doesn't tick boxes for me. That doesn't make me want to do more. So that's me in a nutshell, really.
Honestly, that's just wonderful. And another part of your identity, especially with, is it, it's two books, correctly? Is that,
yes,
correct?
Yes. So I have one book on how to find a talking therapist in the UK.
Yeah.
And then I have Microgains, which is just recently out, which is also helping people with their mental health as well.
And I'm excited about both, but I'm more excited about the latter, the more recent one, because a part of a lot of what I do in terms of my personal history is, like, I'm really fascinated with identities and how do you identify. So I was an athlete, came over to the States to row, and then me and I had a great sports psychologist, and leading up to when I was going to graduate and put down the oar because I was done with it, we spoke a lot and worked through, and it took months, identity. And she said, like, okay, so this identity, this thing, you've come to the States, you're the New Zealand rower, right? You're going to stop that because you're not rowing. And we worked through it. So by the time I finished, I was ready.
Very important. Yeah.
It was so important, but that was a huge privilege and luxury that I could work through it with her. But when I was researching you, I saw, like, part of what did inspire the book, and I want to dive into that, is you kind of, and correct me if I'm wrong, like, were inspired by the sports psychology concept of, like, marginal gains.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so when I saw that, I was like, oh, see, that's the field and the identity I'm more familiar with, of, like,
interesting, yeah.
Sports psychology. But could you please talk through, like, I guess, how marginal gains feeds into micro gains and why that's so important on the mental health conversation?
So we've basically taken the theory, marginal gains, which the idea is, or if you follow particularly British cycling, big part of that, and athletics, other sports as well, if you make small changes in a number of areas, it can really significantly increase your overall performance. So when we're thinking about sporting performance, we've basically taken that concept and gone, how do we use this in mental health, or how can we present this to the public in terms of making tiny little changes? And when we talk about mental health, it's also about physical health, the relationship between the two. So it's your overall well-being. There's a lot of physical health things in the book as well. Is making tiny little changes can make a really big impact on your overall mental health. And the reason that that appealed to me is sometimes even mental health can become a chore. It's a thing we must do. Our social media is flooded with do this, do that, self-care, quite big global concepts, and quite a lot of the time people will start stuff and not finish, or they'll be shamed that they're not doing it. So basically what Emma and I have done, and between us we've got, like, probably 35 years experience, you know, we're seasoned clinicians, is just deconstructing that, making it simple. And the idea is that habit formation is the kind of key. It's about doing tiny little things that become more and more automatic, and you can start wherever. Don't have to follow the book in order. So we're basically just simplifying things, taking the pressure off, but with a nice, would be psychologist if we didn't have a good theoretical background behind it.
I'm so excited. I've ordered it off Amazon. It hasn't arrived yet. I'm so excited.
Is that our first New Zealand order? That's really exciting.
Well, I have to confess, I'm in the States right now. Okay.
So
it's
for our first US, right? Yeah.
No, and I'm so excited to read it, because when we talk about, you're like, marginal gains is a concept I'm really familiar with.
Yes,
and
yeah.
I would tell myself, and sometimes I still do, is like, I don't need motivation. I need discipline. Let's stick to it. So yes. When you talk about the day to day, it's like, I don't need to feel motivated necessarily, but I do need to be disciplined on this.
Yes. And it's kind of making the, how do I, because sometimes when people hear that word disciplined, I think, oh gosh, that's not me. We can get really stuck again, a bit like when you were talking about identities. We can get stuck with the I am and I'm not. I'm not good at following through, or I'm not very disciplined. This isn't going to work with me. And those hooks can then stop us from trying new things. So the idea with this is that almost deconstructing that, of just try little things, practice, rehearse, then it becomes automatic. It takes the pressure away. It's less of a chore of a tick box. And we're more likely to carry on because we'll see the benefits, we'll feel the benefits. And there's your feedback loop.
Okay, I have another side thought that I'm curious for you. Is I was talking to someone about when people learn languages, if you're just doing, no disrespect, if you're doing your Duolingo and you're learning in the UK and you're trying to learn Spanish, right, but you're not speaking Spanish, so it's really hard. But if you suddenly are in a Spanish-speaking country and you're trying to learn the language, you get that instant gratification.
Absolutely, yes.
You go out and you see the value because suddenly you try to order a coffee and you say it in Spanish and it works. And so you're like, oh, this is working. This stuff I'm doing has a result and I'm seeing it. So I'm like,
there's more meaning there, isn't there? Because and there's a lot more, you're learning and processing things through different modalities. So you're seeing, feeling, experiencing the culture, which it's less rote learn, you know, just learning it from a podcast or from a book. When you put someone in a situation where there's meaning and there's lots of different sensory modalities, it's a lot easier to retain and then use the information that you've learned. And there's your loop.
And that's why when you said that with the mental health, I'm like, or the micro gains, it's like when you can identify in the moment, like, oh, that it made me feel better or that worked. Suddenly you get that loop of like, oh, let's keep going. I'm getting, this is making me feel better.
Yeah. And you know what's really lovely? So I sent Emma a little WhatsApp about a week or so before the book came out because I caught myself using some micro gains that I should probably use more often because we've written them. And that kind of, you know, what I love to share is that psychologists can be vulnerable. Sometimes we're not great at looking after ourselves. I was making dinner on a Saturday and rather than rushing and chopping, one of the things that we have in the book, and they're such simple things, is slowing down to notice more rather than I've got to chop, got to get it done, got to get this on by this time because we've got to be here. And just pressing pause. So I kind of stopped in the middle of my slowing down as well and went, oh, I'm just going to breathe for a minute. Oh, actually, I'm going to put some music on while I'm doing this. I'm going to talk to my son while I'm doing this. And that's what allows you to be a bit more present in the moment, which allows you to maybe then notice, oh, do you know what? There's that ache or pain that I still haven't done anything about. Or do you know what? When is the last time I've stopped? So it's about being curious about what you notice as you try these micro gains. So they're not really massive, scientific, life-changing things. It's just simple as slowing down, pressing pause, doing some breathing. You know, it's not rocket science, and that's what we want people to see. It doesn't have to be this really complicated stuff, because that's the stuff that makes us go, no, it's not for me.
And it's so funny that that was the example of the 50 that you just mentioned, because I've been working on that, and I love my phrases. Another one is slow is smooth and smooth is fast. And so sometimes I'm trying to do a lot of different things and I'm
fast-paced.
But when you slow down and then you are more intentional, and like you say, you go, oh, I do actually have an ache in my back, you get that seen to instead of in a month's time when you can't move because your back hurts.
Absolutely.
And you're debilitated. So then that's not fast, is it? So it's like, go back to when, oh, if I slow down, I'm going to notice those things. And then I'm going to deal with it, and that's actually smooth, and then that's fast.
And the other thing about noticing is quite often, so most of us don't want to feel big, horrible, scary emotions. So if we take something like anxiety, stress, anger even, sometimes we'll try and push those feelings or the body sensations that go with them away. But by learning to gently press pause, to take a moment to notice a name, actually they become less scary. Begin to make a little bit of room for them as well. So there's a lot of stuff there about pausing and allowing yourself to feel emotions, to name them. So we kind of drop the battle of pushing stuff away, and as you say, then quite often it can build up. That stress can turn into anxiety, or that stress can become unmanageable stress. So it's really kind of, you know, things will then snowball into other things, to other things. So the whole idea with the micro gains is you use a few, make a bigger change overall, but without loads of effort, because those things will fall into place.
And thank you. Firstly,
it's so interesting, isn't it?
It's so interesting. And like you said there, like the big kind of scary emotions we don't necessarily want to feel is like stress, That's cool. Like, not cool, but like stress and then anxiety, some fear, those things. One that I had recently that I really identified of like, oh, I hate this and I'm going to avoid it by speeding up is like guilt. When I realized I had done something and I was like, oh, and I think guilt's one of those
Sneaky. I call it a sneaky thing because it can kind of creep up.
Yeah.
Sometimes it can suddenly pounce. Sometimes it's there creeping up and you're aware of it. And again, that's where that present moment awareness can be really important. So it's like, okay, you are there, aware of a little bit of guilt, but what can I do even with you showing up? Because sometimes we'll respond to our emotions by pressing pause in our life, right? I'm not going to do that until this anxiety's gone, or, you know, I won't be able to do that. I'm too depressed, too sad. And kind of what a lot of the book is based on theory, and one of the theories that and one of the therapy models that Emma and I love is acceptance and commitment therapy. So it's about making room, compassion-based, value-based therapy, that if we can make a little bit of room for emotions and go, what can I do even with this big emotion or this big physiological symptom showing up? It might be today all I can manage is getting out of bed or getting to work, but there may be another day where you go, I've managed a bit of social connection, or I managed to engage in a bit of a hobby, even if it's just for a minute. So it's, you know, it's kind of moving us away from this all or nothing, and therefore sometimes the mindset that comes with it, I didn't do this today, or therefore I failed because I didn't manage to get through my to-do list, actually just helps us rethink stuff a little bit as well.
It does. You're naturally leading me into all my questions because
sorry, like, no, pain like that.
No, perfect. Is regarding, and I mentioned it again in the intro because there is a lot of content that you've done or people have written for you and with you, and you've collabed and stuff. But one talked about like kind of addressing long-standing misconceptions or just like maybe a viewpoint you've had, and like I just said with the thing I was guilty about, it was guilt because I had had a conversation and I suddenly saw something from a completely different perspective, and I realized like, oh, my old way of thinking, I'm not proud of that. And that's not necessarily a misconception, but it had a parallel for me selfishly when I was like, oh, that was something I stood by for a long, long time, and now I don't. And it's another big question, but for you, like, how do people even address misconceptions, but also realizing like, I've thought this way for a long time. And again, it's embarrassing almost to be like, oh, I don't agree with that anymore. I almost want to bury my head in the sand.
That kind of, again, that's a very kind of similar, isn't it, to making room for tricky emotions. Sometimes we have to make room for tricky thoughts or tricky physical symptoms as well, that, you know, just because that's how we used to think, we need a bit of self-compassion, that it's all right to evolve, it's all right for our values to change, it's all right for us to have new ways of thinking, therefore, and just knowing what to do with those old hooky, I call that the inner critic. If you imagine this big kind of monster that creeps up and says, hey, this is you, or if there's guilt or shame even attached to the fact that you used to think a certain way and you don't identify that way, it's just going, thanks so much, brain. Your brain's just sending you this stuff to protect you, basically. It's your protector. But sometimes the way that it does it is a little bit irritating, and it can mean that we're paying attention to the hooky stuff and not engaging in our value-laden life. So it's really just about going, thanks. Thanking the mind's a wonderful thing. We have that in the book as well. It's a really common ACT strategy of just kind of going, thanks so much, brain, for sending me that really difficult thought, but I've got this, and I'm going to see what I can do even with that guilt showing up or those memories of how I used to think, and just lean in. We call it leaning in to tricky stuff. What can I do even with that tricky stuff? And you'll probably be quite surprised what you can do.
Interesting. So when you say like it's the protector, why?
So our brain basically is designed, in a nutshell, to absorb all of the negative things that happen to us so it can use that information in case that situation shows up in the future. That's the real, just a basic kind of level explanation of it. We quite often will not remember the wonderful day out that we had, or remember the one thing that went wrong, because our brain is designed to need that information. It doesn't really need information. It doesn't keep us safe to remember how wonderful that picnic was or what the sunset looked like. It needs to know where the potential threat is. So that's why it's really good at sending us really hooky negative stuff, because it thinks, well, if I did used to think that way and I've got guilt or shame attached, what if that shows up in the future? What if that way that I used to think comes up and haunts me in some way. So that's unfortunately why I love to throw it at us at any, and it can be at any given opportunity. You can be having the most wonderful time, can't you? And then your brain will go, I know, I need to send you the thought that this could happen, or this has happened in 1992. And you need to pay attention to it right now. And what we need to do is to remember that our brain is trying to keep us safe. And sometimes that information can be really useful. You know, if you're crossing the street, you've judged a car and its speed, and then actually you realise you've misjudged, you need your brain to go, hang on a minute, we've got this wrong, step back on the pavement. But if our brain is going, oh, that time in 1992 where you did that thing in the playground and you felt like an idiot, you can kind of go, actually, I don't quite need that information, but thanks so much. It's, you know, it's kind of just being kind to yourself. And we could spend all day up in our heads going through everything and running through everything we've ever done, but we're not in the moment. We're not, as we look at our watch going, here I am, and I'm trying to enjoy life and do what I can with the time that we've got. Life's too short to spend in our heads hooking with tricky stuff.
Thank you so much. So yeah, that's when you say you acknowledge it, like, thank you brain, you're doing your job.
Yeah,
you brought that up. And I also think too, as I'm 25 and as I'm getting older, I look back and I, like, when I was 17 and I did something, I was, oh, Grace, like, why'd you do this? And now I look back, I'm like, oh, 17's just a baby. But, like, I can look back with...
more compassionate to yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. When it's age, for some reason, I can look back and go, like, you were trying to do this, this, and this. But, like, I can't do that in the present because I'm as old as I've ever been right now. And being so you expect more of yourself. But, yeah, compassion.
People always think compassion is a little bit kind of unscientific. But actually, there's a huge scientific basis behind compassion for ourselves, compassion for other people, and I'd urge people to kind of read up on that, because sometimes culturally in different countries around the world, it's still, or being compassionate is still a little bit woo-woo, or it's not robust enough. But if we can be kinder to ourselves in terms of how we've responded to stuff in the past, or what we're doing now, how we're dealing with things, so you might get through the day. I've just had a wonderful conversation with a UK doctor on my podcast. Both of us mental health professionals, both of us have days where we go, I don't think I've eaten well. And my brain's now beating me up and going, you've not done this. You've broken your months of wonderful nutrition. Being kind and compassionate and going, come on, brain, why are you doing this? It's just a day. And, you know, and catching that. Because spend the rest of the week hooking with how bad we are and what we haven't done. But what's that going to achieve? It's just going to mean that we're not present and leaning into life and doing things that we mean and value. And it's just about catching. I call it catch. Imagine you've got a little fishing net, like the kind you used to have as a kid, you know, a little coloured net and a bamboo stick, and catching those thoughts and kind of going, do I need to pay attention to this right now? And if you don't, thanks, brain, but I'm kind of busy. I'm on this podcast. So I could have anxiety about performance on this podcast. I value doing this podcast. So I might have to say to my brain, thanks so much for saying, I probably sound like an idiot. Everyone's switched off by now, whatever. And I could hook with that and say, sorry, Grace, I've just got to put you on pause for a moment while I deal with my brain. Or I can go, take a seat, negative thoughts, and I'll just see what I can do on this podcast because it matters. And I'm leaning into it.
Leaning into it.
Yeah.
Thank you. That is
really simple.
That is so wonderful. And again, I often bring up my sports analogies of, like, I had Jonah Oliver, he's a performance psychologist, like that. Oh, sorry. High performance stuff. But he said something that was right there where he says with his athletes or his business, whatever it is, he talks about building capacity around it. So it's like,
lovely concept.
Such a concept that for me, like you just said, was a click where I'm like, yeah, I still have to do the thing I need to do. And instead of letting the performance anxiety take up 80% of my brain, you don't say, like, oh, I need to, like you said, deal with it or try to get rid of it or minimize. You just build capacity. I like to think of it as trust your training, trust what you can do, and go, like, hey, you're there, cool, but I still know I can do what I need to do and I'm going to focus on that.
You might not realize it's actually really a compassionate approach. And I guess as well, what I've kind of learned, you know, I had someone who's a sports psychologist on my podcast when I first started, and I just found it so, so interesting, is that, you know, how much getting hooked with that might then impact your performance, how powerful the brain can be in directing how we respond. And that vicious circle, because then what do you notice? And how do you respond?
You just notice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And what he said that helped me, and so I'm so excited because as you've been talking, there's things that are also like aha moments. And he said, like, if you think of it like lactic acid, he was very athletic with me. You know, when you do an exercise, that lactic acid's going to come. Are you scared of it? And I'm like, well, no. He's like, is it going to prevent you from doing the thing? I was like, oh, no, sometimes it can make it harder, but no. He's like, is it actually a sign that maybe you're doing something correct? And I said, oh, yeah, it's like part of the process. And he's like, okay, so like you, what if that's those tricky feelings like lactic acid? It's there. It's a sign that your brain's doing what it should be doing, trying to protect you. And you just go like, oh, okay, that's my brain doing its thing, but I got to continue on with what I was going to do.
Same with feelings, right? So we are inherently social beings. We want to be around other people. We feel stuff. We have to feel stuff, you know, to know if we're safe. But we also feel stuff because it's enjoyable. You know, we enjoy being with certain people. We like the dopamine hit we get when we do certain activities or with certain people. So part of life is leaning into the good stuff, the bad stuff. And actually, I kind of like that mentality that, you know, if life was happy all the time, if we were chasing the happy, we wouldn't really notice the happy. We need to have the ups and the downs, and sounds a bit cheesy, but all the stuff that's in between, it's part of life, you know. And sometimes having a cry together, having a laugh together, it's all part of it. But I do think in society at the moment there is a little bit of this kind of, you know, we mustn't feel bad stuff, got to try and get rid of it. And one of the things that I love about acceptance and commitment therapy is just demystifying that and just saying, you know, life is experiences and we roll with it, feel it, kind of part of what we are, really. But it's just kind of demystifying that for people.
Yes, and I was going to say, have you seen, I know it's a children's movie, Inside Out, and then Inside Out 2, and Inside Out 1, exactly, it was like actually sadness. Her
we
job,
needed sadness,
she brought people together, and that's,
And look what happens when somebody battled to try and silence or get rid of sadness.
Yeah.
And I guess, again, when it kind of comes to how people, I like preventative well-being. Sometimes we do have things that happen, life throws us huge curveballs, you know, loss, grief, depression, anxiety, stress, trauma even, and we do need to respond to it in that moment. But the model that I think that we should be taking is preventative, little things that we do every day, which is part of why we wrote that book. But part of that is also just knowing how to deal with everyday emotions and to be able to just feel those little things every day so that we don't then keep things at a distance. Because the problem with that, then, if we try and avoid all the sadness and the anxiety and the stress, when it does finally kind of build up to a point where it's too much, we don't know what to do. I mean, almost panic even more. So we're just fighting this battle. It gives them more control, really, or more power. You know, we almost put these emotions on a pedestal of things never to be allowed or never to feel, and then they build up more and more in our minds. So we all know, as therapists, psychologists, the more you try and avoid anxiety, the worse it is. So we've got to try, if we can, lean in a bit earlier. So part of the microgreens is learning how to just very gently name and sit with feelings, and then it takes the power out of them, it takes how scary they are out of them. And just, it's a bit of a cheesy word, but normalizing. You know, we're going to have rubbish days, we're going to have okay days, and we might have better days, and then that's okay. Or we could even have that within an hour. We could have 10 minutes ago I was a bit sad, but now I'm okay, and actually I've had quite a nice half an hour, little snippet of joy, and that could be okay too.
So part of what I guess lights my fire with the podcast and my purpose is addressing tall poppy syndrome, which I know is called different things. I just learned yesterday that I think it's in China, they say like the tallest tree gets the wind. Also, like, it's actually everywhere. Yeah. It's just called different things. So without leading the question too much, could you please describe to me how you would describe tall poppy syndrome, and then how you've experienced it?
You know, so the thing that I thought, I'm probably completely way off compared with other people, but that is me in a nutshell, is I see it. People that perhaps just do something a little bit different. So you've got a whole field of poppies, they all look the same, but what are the ones that just that little bit different? So that might be how you see something, how you experience something, or also how you do stuff. And sometimes I see myself as a little bit of a tall poppy because I do stand out in how I see and work with mental health and who I work with. So I don't know if what your take on it is, but for me, that's the metaphor that kind of stands out, that it's okay to be a bit different. That, you know, we have this wonderful thing called the herd instinct, which kind of keeps us safe. But the problem with that, with wanting to stick with the herd, is it sometimes keeps us a bit too safe and we might not step outside of that comfort zone. So, you know, there may be people listen to this that think, I want to try something new. There's something there I could do to support people's mental health. But, oh, it's not what everyone else is doing. As long as it's safe and it's a robust model, go for it. Try it and refine as you go. And I heard this, I think, I'm trying to think what podcast it was on recently, but there was an entrepreneur saying that quite often we would just put off things until we have the perfect solution rather than try, refine. And I love that model. And I always say, as long as something's ethical and safe and the model's robust, try. So that's me as a tall poppy, and I am really tall as well, so that also fits quite nicely. You won't tell in the podcast, but super tall as well.
I'm also reasonably, I'm not quite 6 foot, I wish I was, but I'm close. No, thank you, because I'm smiling as you said that with the tall poppy, because it is in New Zealand how we see it, is sticking out, being a bit different. But the culture, particularly in New Zealand, is that for that one poppy, and it tends to grow a little bit more, we chop it down. But you, and this is me projecting, this is not at all, this is just me thinking about what you've said, is like, you have seen such impact and positiveness from your different way of thinking, from your curiosity. So in terms of the feedback loop we talked about, you're like, heck yeah, I'm not the same as
it's not
the
so bad
poppies.
It kind of helps with imposter syndrome a little bit sometimes, that it's okay to do stuff differently. But as long as, and that's coming back, so that's why I love acceptance and commitment therapy so much, coming back to your value. So I still, you know, it's not about kind of trying stuff and it being dangerous and just rushing in. It's about trying stuff, but with a good baseline of ethics and research and, you know, knowing where you need to come back to. So you refine and you're innovative, I guess that's the word I love to use, but at the same time you've got a good healthy baseline of safety and robustness, which as a psychologist we should have as well.
Marvelous. Tara, before I ask my sign-off question, and I'm aware that there could be quite a few, but is there anything I have not asked you that I should have during this interview?
Oh, no, it's been really interesting because I've had questions I've never had before, which I always love. So again, that's kind of innovative. Sometimes you can have a bit of a formulaic approach on a podcast when it's about mental health, but I love the fact that we haven't done that today. And if I added a question in, that would make it formulaic, I think.
Thank you, because in terms of being kind to myself, like that comment where you say like questions I haven't had before,
yeah, it's nice,
coolest thing, because I put in quite a lot of time to listen to your prior podcast or listen to things and be like,
yeah,
okay, Tara's said that before, if people want to hear that they can find it somewhere else. What's going to give you an experience with me who that goes like,
it's different,
yeah, you leave and you go like, huh,
I'm going away thinking about stuff rather than just leaving stuff. The listeners,
yes,
which to me, that's tall poppy, it's different. You know, the whole idea of, and that's how we should be as mental health professionals, as mental health practitioners, we are not the experts, we are not the people that should have the, you know, the power balance should be equal between whether I have a client in the therapy room, whether I'm on a podcast or with a group of people working on a project. We learn from each other. So when I go on podcast, it's not just to give a message out, it's not to plug something, it's to learn and hopefully get a bit better and, you know, learn new concepts, things to take away that I can then basically steal and use in the rest of my work, otherwise known as flatter you by saying, it's really interesting, thank you.
Thank you so
I'm good at
much.
Theft. That's really interesting. I'm going to think about that more and bring that into my work. So it's quite nice to know that everybody helps everybody.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, no art is ever original, right? Like, yeah, everything's inspired by something else.
And I think we can do so much more. The one thing I will say about the mental health space is sometimes people can be so protective over what they do. I feel it can sometimes be a bit of a hindrance. So if there are people with same views, and let's share each other's stuff and get it out there. It's not about trying to raise your game compared with someone else's. It's, for me, mental health well-being is about that one person that listens and goes, that's really interesting, and I might not have heard that somewhere else, or I might not have access to therapy to kind of hear some of these concepts. So I always welcome the opportunity to learn new stuff, to collaborate. It's why I collaborate with people a lot. Share stuff, you know, that's what we need to do. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Tara. My sign-off question is...
Can't wait.
Like you said, just to throw something else in, is if you had to listen to just one musical artist... Ooh. For the rest of your life, who's it going to be?
I am so, probably the worst person to ask this to. I have the most cheesy, embarrassing taste of music ever. Just one artist for the rest of your life. You can edit this out. Shall I say two? And then you can edit one out if it's really awful. Shall I go with the gut one?
Yes.
Yes, go. I always don't want to say it. Michael Bublé. Mr. Chocolate Voice, as I call him. Seen him multiple times. I am not embarrassed to say I could just listen to him sing 24 hours a day for the rest of my life.
I love that. And also we're heading into the season.
Oh, I know. It's
where his voice
Christmas
is going to be
time.
On.
I might even put it on after this, actually. He has the most wonderful, I think he's great for everyone's mental health because his voice is just so wonderful. And he's an all-round good egg as well.
He is. One of my favorite like clips I've seen is with Michael Bublé, and he says like he was advertising, I think, his Christmas album, and he said in a joking way, "Go buy it, because if you don't buy your Christmas one, I'm coming for Easter. I'm coming." Like he's like, "I'm gonna take the other holidays."
He can lean into the cringe, right, and own that cringe. And do you know what I really love? So I've seen him multiple times live. Is that he is not someone that is just about raising his own profile. So he has a massive band, sometimes 20, 30 musicians, and he gives them time and solos and individual. You know, it's about the collective. So he wouldn't sing the way he didn't. Did without that band behind him, and they are not just there to support him, they're part of it. And for me, that ticks a lot of values as well. It's not just about the music and the kind of artist. It's, for me, it's the whole thing and ethics and values, and I love that. So it's enjoyable. You know, it's memories, it creates memories. Music will remind you of where you were, and if you followed an artist like him for many years, then there are different memories that you can go back to at times in your life that will always be special. So that's nice too.
Tara, Dr. Quinn, thank you so much for being
welcome.
On Tall Poppy Talk. I'm excited to read your book. I'm excited for other people to read.
Hope
it.
You
just
enjoy it.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much for listening to Tall Poppy Talk. We'll see you next time. Feel free to check us out on socials, YouTube, and the website. Thanks for today's